Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the QuickBook Reviews podcast. Brighten your day with a book.
Hello, my fellow bookworms. This is Philippa from QuickBook Reviews, author interviews and book reviews. How are you doing today? I hope you're okay. I hope all's well. I am continuing to recover from the dreaded whooping cough. Honestly, but somebody said it lasts. It's part of this 100-day cough nonsense. It's fun, isn't it? Can't wait for 100 days of this. Lovely. But at least there are books to talk about. Now, I'm moving on with reading the Women's Prize long list, fiction long list, but I'm going to save that for another episode. I'd rather get through a good few of them before I talk to you about those. So today, we have three books. We've got The Last Murder at the End of the World by Stuart Turton. We've got Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner. And we've got Eye for an Eye by MJ Arledge. Those are your books. Let's get stuck in. So the first one, The Last Murder at the End of the World by Stuart Turton. Stuart, you will have heard about. He has written some absolutely super books already. We've had The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, The Devil in the Dark Water. So this is his third one. And let me tell you a little bit about this book. Outside the island, there is nothing. The world destroyed by a fog that swept the planet, killing anyone it touched. On the island, it is idyllic, 122 villagers and three scientists, living in peaceful harmony. The villagers are content to fish, farm and feast, to obey their nightly curfew, to do what they're told by the scientists. Until, to the horror of the islanders, one of their beloved scientists is found brutally stabbed to death. They also learn that the murder has triggered a lowering of the security system around the island, the only thing that was keeping the fog at bay. If the murder isn't solved within 92 hours, the fog will smother the island and everyone on it. And what I like through the book is that it's a countdown, so you know how many hours are left until the fog covers the island. After the prologue, it starts with 91 hours until humanity's extinction. Obviously, I didn't like the fact that we're talking about humanity's extinction, but I did the fact that there was that countdown. I really enjoyed this book. I thought it's got that dystopian element. It's got crime. It's just a fascinating book. It kept me gripped. I had no idea what was going on some of the time. I was just like, what? And yet it all ties up at the end. You're like, oh, right. I would imagine this will be on television because I could see it happening. But anyway, enough of me. Let's talk to Stuart now. Stuart, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a privilege.
It's great to talk to you. Always enjoyed your books. Now, for those who haven't read this one, can you give a little summary, please?
So The Last Murder at the End of the World is, do you know what? This is one of the first times I've had to describe it. So I'm trying to shuffle it all into my head. It's set 90 years after the world has ended. Everybody died. I'm really sorry about that, but everyone's dead. 122 people survived, and they are living a beautiful life on a small Greek island. It's completely idyllic. There's no murder. There's no violence. There's no arguments of any sort. Everyone is genuinely completely happy. But there are some oddities on the island. There's a voice in everybody's head which kind of tells them what to do, how they should behave, and sort of looks after them, is very kind and kindly. There's three elders on the island, and they're the only people who remember before the apocalypse. They're very, very old. Nobody really understands what's going on there. And then they have curfews, a time at night when they just fall asleep and there's nothing they can do about it. They just, at 7:30 at night, they just collapse and fall asleep wherever they are. So it's a very strange island with lots and lots of secrets on it. But as I say, no arguments, no murder, no violence. And then one morning, one of the elders, they wake up and one of the elders has been murdered. So it's up to one of these people who's never experienced violence of any sort, even an argument, to work out what murder is, why it happens, and who killed this person on this paradise island. And it's bonkers. It's absolutely bonkers.
Yes, my next question was going to be, how many cups of coffee had you consumed when you came up with the idea for this book?
It's more, it's not even cups of coffee. It's like my adult brain. It's really hard for me to sit down and write. I find it really, really hard to sit down at a computer for 8 hours a day and write a book. It's not what I want to spend my time doing. I want to be outside climbing mountains or going for runs or hanging out with my children. Literally anything that's not this job. So in order to make this time interesting and to get me sat at a computer, I've got to have these books with these big twists and hooks and lots of surprises and lots of interesting characters and scenarios, because that's just interesting for me to write. And I know that every day there'll be something for me to do that's a bit different. So yeah, out of that process, I sort of spin these quite elaborate books with quite elaborate conceits.
And as well as big twists and elaborate stories, you seem to be a fan of big titles and elaborate titles as well. Is that another favourite of yours?
I think it is. I think I'm always looking for, it's like, because you know how hard it is. You walk into a bookshop, and not to state the obvious, but there's a lot of books in there. There's just tons of them. And I've never found a one-word title to be particularly intriguing. There's not many of them that if I'm just going to walk past a shelf and say a book, I'm going to pick that one-word title up. If it was just called like Guilt, I'm probably going to pick that up. It's not going to do much for me. But something like The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, I always would have picked that book up. The Devil in the Dark Water, my second one, I would have picked that book up. And now The Last Murder at the End of the World, I definitely would pick that book up. So it's just it's just me with one eye on readers, being busy and walking through crowded bookshops, not knowing what they're going to buy, and just looking at a title and being, that's enough for me to pick that book up and have a little look at the back. And then hopefully the big conceit and the big plot can hook them in.
Makes sense. Were there particular events or issues that you wanted to address in this book? Or was it just you got the idea and you just wanted to write it?
The themes and stuff always come out while you're writing it, which is kind of interesting. You never, at least I don't, I never sit down with a thematic concern that's bothering me. I sit down because I've got an interesting scenario. For this one, I knew about the island, I knew about the apocalypse. What I initially wanted to do was a kind of John Wyndham meets Agatha Christie kind of novel. That was my elevator pitch when I started. And that just sounded really interesting to me, and I wasn't sure what it would take me. But this is what this came out of. And then the more you write it, the more, obviously, if you're doing an apocalypse novel, why did the world end? Probably because of something dumb that we all collectively did. So you start getting into these themes, you start having your characters reflect on this. And then if you've created an island that doesn't have murder, you automatically start to get into the nature of murder. You start to get into, why are we all so fascinated by this truly awful thing? Why is it accepted in our culture? Why is it entertainment in our culture? Have we gone very badly wrong? Is it something in our natures that allows us, this is how we process something terrible, and it's actually a defense mechanism? Is it something else going on? So all this stuff just starts to bubble up as you're writing, because naturally that's where your story is taking you.
And yet it does seem to reflect, or I felt it was very much of this time and reflecting the sort of the themes that we're facing and pondering at the moment in the world. So it was, a very timely book, certainly for me to read, I thought.
Thank you. And that's one of the things, like I was writing the book, it's got sci-fi elements in it, and it's got lots of sort of like future looking and speculative elements. But there's no point writing a book for the audience you may have in 50 years time. That's not going to work at all. So you're constantly writing with an eye on who's reading it right now. What do they get out of it? Will they enjoy it? What are they going to read into it? So you've always got, I'm just always trying to work with my reader. I'm always trying to work out, what are they thinking right now, so I can subvert it or second guess it or go around it or wrong foot them. And out of that comes, what are you going to get out of this book when you're reading it? What are you going to be bothered by? I like that. I like that sort of, it's like chatting to readers all the way through writing it, because otherwise it's an incredibly lonely process.
Mm. Did the characters come to you just sort of one by one, or did a coach load of them arrive together and in your mind?
I knew I had this island. I knew I had a bunch of people who didn't really remember the apocalypse, and a bunch of people who spent their entire lives being told by this voice in their head to be nice. Just be nice, be kind. And they are nice and kind and selfless. They are I wanted to plot a book that a murder mystery novel where there weren't any obvious suspects. And not in the sense that everyone was somewhere else so they couldn't have done it, but in the sense that morally, ethically, just even psychologically, these people are not geared up to commit a murder. There's almost no way any of them could have done it. I really love that as a plotting challenge. I really like that as a reading challenge as well, that readers go in. I don't think they'll have seen that before. I don't think that's a common thing that's been done before. I started off with that basis, and then out of that, you still have to sort of find drama. It's very hard to find drama amongst a bunch of very nice people. Like, it's really hard to sort of, like, they don't clash, so you don't automatically get that stuff. So I spent a long time working on these characters and working out what would the outlier be, what could someone be selfless and kind and lovely, what would sort of drive them apart from everybody else, what would be the characteristic that people would find annoying. And it just turned out to be like a questioning nature, somebody who's not content with the world around them. And that's kind of how the characters grew, and they grew in relation to my protagonist, Emery.
And I'm interested in the voice that people hear with the audiobook version, because obviously I've read the book, I haven't listened to it. How is that going to work? How will that voice come across?
I think that's their job, to be honest. We've selected an actress for it who's really good, really, really good.
And for myself, having read the book, I think I would like to go back and listen to it as an audiobook as well, because I think that would be really interesting to see how it's narrated and almost dramatized.
For me as well, because I think, as you said, it's such a, the entire book is narrated from this viewpoint. So the idea of having an audiobook almost fits more perfectly the format than writing does. So I've never gone back, because I don't read my books again. I'm once they're out in the world, I'm not that interested. But I think this may be the one where I would go back and maybe listen to at least 25% of it as an audiobook, just to see how that story carries through when it is a voice. Because it is brilliant. It's a voice in your head in the book. And if you listen to an audiobook, it is going to be a voice in your head narrating it to you. I think there's something wonderful about that that would be really unique.
But we mustn't ignore the printed version, Stuart, because it's fair to say that there's a special printed version of the book with sprayed edges that is one of the most beautiful things I have seen. Were you chuffed when you saw that?
Oh, I'm delighted. The team that produces my books at Bloomsbury and other partners, it's something else, mate. It's every time I see one, you can't imagine the excitement of like a cover coming in and like you've written all the words and then you send it off and then you wait and you wait and you wait. And then finally a cover gets revealed to you. And then the cover of this one is the most beautiful cover I think of in all my books and possibly any book that's ever existed. And then from that, then come things like sprayed edges and special editions. And it's just this amazing, you've created something that's then fired somebody else's creativity in another entire discipline. There's something incredibly wonderful about that that I adore, that I did a thing and then off the back of that, somebody else has done a thing. And then somebody off the back of that has done yet another thing. It's this lovely ripple effect. Yeah, I would please everyone go out and buy the special editions, because they look amazing on a bookshelf. They just, even if you never read the book, who cares? It looks incredible.
I saw someone had said, I promised myself I was never buying another sprayed edge. And then I saw Stuart Turton's new book and
pre-order.
Yes, yes. People are swooning, Stuart. They're swooning at the book.
It goes back to that thing, doesn't it? That it's so much, there's so much competition now, and it's really hard to sell a book, and people have got less money than they've ever had. And there's so many other things for people to spend their money on. It's just in terms of entertainment, forget like food and living, that you want to give people as much incentive to buy a book and own the book as you possibly can. Sprayed edges, the maps inside, there's loads of design work that's not in the proof. Like, it's a genuinely beautiful object beyond even the story.
Oh, so there's a map inside the final version. Oh, because I don't have that on mine. Oh, how exciting.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Oh, yes. Listeners, there is a lovely map. The Last Island at the End of the World. And it's a map of that. It's beautiful. Oh,
yeah. There's lots of beautiful. And then we've also got, as is necessary for a murder mystery, we've got a nice little list of suspects there. And
oh, perfect. And I love it because it's It's a one-page list. You haven't got 10 pages of characters that I always feel I'm failing at from the beginning because I can't remember everybody's name and their role from the get-go.
That has been, in the past, I've done that. I love doing that. I love, like, both my previous novels are about 130,000 words. Like, huge, huge novels, huge mystery novels with, like, multiple pages of characters in them and lots of epic stuff going on. So for this one at the outset, I was like, this one's going to be 90,000 words. Like, I just want to write a shorter novel. Like, it was in my head from the beginning. So I'm really pleased that that has happened. And obviously, as part of that, you need to have fewer characters. It's a weird little challenge to set yourself just to be like, stop being verbose. Just cut it down, 90,000 words, call it a day. People have got lives. They've got things to get on with.
And was it that you just wrote the 90,000-ish words, or did you write substantially more, and it was only through editing that you were able to reach that sweet spot?
Oh no, I wrote an entire book. I wrote 111,000 words that I threw away. Like, I wrote the wrong book first, and that took me a year. And then at the end of it, I was just like, this is garbage. This is not what I wanted to do. I've gone wrong. But I had to write the entire thing so I could work out what I actually wanted to write. So I tossed that one and started again with a blank page. Yes, I threw away an entire book before I got to this one.
And is that something you do with your books? Because you're not the only author who's done that.
Yeah, I do it all the time. So I did it. Seven Deaths, I threw away about 70,000 words, 70,000, I can't really remember. But it's a very specific problem that I'd had with that novel, where that book was very tightly plotted. And one small change in that plot meant that the entire novel collapsed. It was just the nature of that story. And I had one small idea that wasn't in the plot, so I wrote, and it just took me off in a zigzag, and I just couldn't get back to the main thrust of the plot, so I had to cut away that branch of the tree. And then Devil was similar. Devil was initially constructed as like this three-act epic taking place in three different locations, and each one was kind of almost its own book. And that didn't work either, so I tossed away two-thirds of that. It is part of the process, and I keep thinking it's a mistake I'm making, that I'm going to learn from it and get better. But it actually just seems to be the process, which is genuinely really annoying.
Yes, I think it's Gillian McAllister who writes a similar amount, if not more, that she ends up throwing away. So yes, you're not on your own there with the pain. But if it ends up producing these books, then I suppose it's just part of the process for you.
I think that's the thing. I wish there was I had a more direct way to create the thing that I want to create and work out what it is I want to create. But I always start with what feels like a very grounded idea that feels manageable, feels like has strong characters, a really strong hook. And I always start with that. And then I write it. And then I'm like, that doesn't work on the page. For whatever reason, there's always lots of things going on. Maybe I'm not actually that invested in the characters that I've created or the plot. As you write it down, it becomes nonsensical, or you have to reach so far to make it work. But it always happens. And then through that process, I can dig back down and just be like, well, I kind of like that thematic thing that I'm doing there, or that's an interesting character thing that sort of emerged out of the ether. So I can take that with me. Or maybe that's a part of the plot that I really enjoy. And maybe that thing that I threw away in three chapters is the thing I should be entirely focusing on. So it's an odd magnifying glass, if that makes sense. Like writing all those words, it just takes me that amount of time, that amount of words to work out what the book should be.
And talking of the book, you're going to read us a little bit from the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Again, as we spoke in the audiobook, will eventually be truly beautiful. But for the minute, you get this lovely, dulcet Scouse narrator. Okay, so this is from the prologue. I've never written a prologue to a novel before, but this one feels very fitting. So hopefully when you read it, it'll make sense. Is there no other way? Asks a horrified Nima Mandropilius, speaking out loud in an empty room. She has olive skin and a smudge of ink on her small nose. Her grey hair is shoulder length and her eyes are strikingly blue, with flecks of green. She looks to be around 50 and has done for the last 40 years. She's hunched over her desk, lit by a solitary candle. There's a pen in a trembling hand and a confession beneath it that she's been trying to finish for the last hour. None that I can see, I reply in her thoughts. Somebody has to die for this plan to work.
Very, very good. Very good. I mean, we're not looking for any spoilers at all, but did you know when you started writing the book how it was going to end and the big events?
Yeah, it's funny. I can't really, obviously you can't normally talk about an ending anyway, but you can talk about sort of thematically what you were trying to achieve. Because what I always do when I'm planning is I'll start with a murder, because I always want to write an impossible murder or a locked room murder or something that is difficult to solve. And in the real world, there's absolutely no reason to ever kill anybody this way, right? You just hit them with a brick or shoot them with a gun or whatever it is, stab them in the heart. You're trying to always balance this fantastical act with something that feels real, like a real motivation why this thing had to happen this way. And out of that, I usually get the character of the victim, the character of the murderer, why this happened, why it had to be. Like, you get all this other supplementary information, and then I use that to plan backwards. With this one, there was a very specific thought I had about the ending that I was really interested in following through on and seeing whether I could plot and seeing whether it would be interesting and satisfying and fulfilling. And I can't really talk too much more about it, but that was the thing that was in my head. That's what drove this murder and the way it's committed and who commits it and why it happens this way. Because I really wanted to get to an end of a book having done that and having put that into print. So that's what governed it. Sorry to be sort of enigmatic.
No, that makes sense. I mean, focusing on this sort of the theme of murders in all your books, it's interesting because it's almost genre busting, this sort of book. Where would, apart from putting it in fiction, what other areas would a bookshop place it in? But are you concerned about that? Or is it more that your name is known for, yes, being about a murder, but not being about one very specific genre, just being something more, just different and more challenging like that?
I don't think anybody knows who I am. I don't think my name carries any particular weight. I think, again, I'm doing simple things. I'm trying to write stories that they're always crime books. When I'm drifting across genres, I am always very keenly aware of the genres that I'm working in. With Seven Deaths, my first novel, that was an Agatha Christie in a Groundhog Day loop. But I understand crime and I understand the tropes of crime and I understand what a reader of crime is going to expect. That's always the string in every novel I write. Like, I hit all the beats of a crime novel. There's always a body. There's always an investigator. There's red herrings. There's all the things that you'd expect a crime novel to do. And then once you've got that solid foundation, as long as you understand the genres that you're working in, so if it's a bit of science fiction, if it's a bit of fantasy, if it's a bit of maritime mystery or a boat book, as my second one was, you can then take bits of those genres, not all of it. You take the bits that help your story and you layer it on your string. They become the beads. But at heart, it's always a crime book. No matter what else is going on, the thing that you're following through is if you understand how a crime novel's going to work, you'll understand how this novel's going to work. It'll throw you for a loop and it will surprise you, and hopefully it'll zig when you expect it to zag. But fundamentally, it will always be a crime book.
And as well as being a crime book, you've mentioned Agatha Christie a few times. Is that sort of a key influence or the part of the key parts of the jigsaw?
Yeah, very much, because I love her. So I grew up, she was the first author where I religiously read all her novels. I did it between about 8 and 12 when I found my next door neighbour would bring them home from car boot sales. And she just started doing it one day. There was nobody asked her. She just did it. She was like, I know Stu reads a lot. I think you might like these. She gave me 3 of them. They're obviously 70,000 words, so I blasted through them in a weekend. And then I was like, please, I can have some more. So every weekend she would go to car boot sales and bring me back more Agatha Christie's. So I just read and read and read these Agatha Christie novels, and it taught me a lot. Because I read it at that formative age, it kind of imprinted upon me as, this is what a book should be. This is the way, this is the structure.
Yeah.
And the fact that she messed with structure always, I adored. Like, you would read 10 of these things, and then suddenly one would turn up and she'd have done something with her own. She'd be thwarting your belief in what her book should be, or she'd be playing with it because she understood you as much as she understood the genre. It was amazing. So when it came time for me to write a book, and I've said this multiple times, so it's completely true, all I ever wanted to do was write an Agatha Christie novel. I didn't want to be a novelist. I had no aspirations to be a crime author. I wanted to write one Agatha Christie novel. That was all I wanted to do, and do the things that she did. And it was astonishing. Like, it was Seven Deaths was the book that came out of that. Like, this quite traditional Agatha Christie novel with all the tropes, the isolated country house, the guests, all that sort of stuff. But layered on top of that was this sci-fi element, because otherwise she's written all the Agatha Christie books. She's done every version of that story. She's done every great hook and every great character and every great murder. So you really have to go some to do something that she's not done.
Stuart, my question is about publishing and whether publication day for you is an absolute joy or not. Is it pain or pleasure, the actual publication day?
Oh, it's a righteous terror. It's awful. Not necessarily because of the reviews, because usually by publication day, you've got a fair idea of how the novel's been received already, because it's gone out to bloggers and it's gone out to NetGalley reviewers and it's gone out to people like yourself. Like, so people have got it. It's more that, like, this is your job. So this is presentation day. So, like, you need it to sell X amount of copies, because if it doesn't sell X amount of copies, then your payments for that year are going to be through the floor. And if your payments are through the floor, then you're not buying your children shoes or like food. So there's a really practical element to it for me, that this is my job, and how the book sells directly determines what my pay for the year is going to be. And obviously I want to give my kids and my family as much as we can possibly get. Yeah, it's always slightly terrifying to see those first week sales start to come in and know whether you're going to hit that bestseller list, know whether you're going to continue to sell this book, because the huge part of it is, yes, it needs to sell up well from the first week, but then it needs to carry on, and word of mouth needs to spread. And watching that happen, yeah, it's terrifying, utterly terrifying. And you sort of like want to divorce yourself away from that, but you can't, because if the book doesn't sell over the next 12 months, then it's like having a job that doesn't pay you anything. That's an incredibly difficult position to be in.
Yes, money is quite important in this day and age, yes. And just hearing, I'm sure it must be amazing, though, to see photos of people buying it and getting their feedback. Yeah, a nervous time, but a good time.
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that for me, it's, and again, I think I sound a lot more pragmatic than a lot of authors sometimes, but for me, it's very sort of like the end of a project. Like, whatever project, whatever work that you've got, it takes me 2 years to write a novel. It takes 3 years for the novel to come out, because there's such a long lead time in publishing. You send the manuscript in, it gets edited, covers get designed, marketing takes over. So yeah, 2 years to write, 3 years to come out. So for me, this was over a year ago, like a year and a half ago, and I've moved on to something else. I'm writing new stuff. And so when it comes out, I can officially put that one to bed. Like, it's not, there's nothing more I can do about it. So there's a real sort of like cutting of the cord feeling for me. Overall relief, and more than anything else, it's a real sense of, right, that one's to bed. You can fully focus on the next thing now. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Stuart, we come to the final question, which is the most crucial one on this podcast, and it concerns the subject of biscuits. And what we want to know is, what biscuit powered the writing of The Last Murder at the End of the World? What was your biscuit of choice?
Oh my God, I'm going to make myself unpopular. I don't actually like biscuits that much.
Oh, Stuart.
I know. I'm so sorry, pal. It's a cup of tea. I love a cup of tea. So it's tea and coffee is what I procrastinate with. So every time I don't know what I'm doing next, I will go out. I've got an office at the end of my garden, so I will leave and then go down to the house and I will make myself a cup of tea and have a little think about it. And then I will wander back up. That's my little routine. I'll do that about 5 times a day, either tea or coffee. So back and forth. But yeah, I don't like biscuits that much. Three things that puzzle people is that, yeah, I don't like biscuits that much. I don't like pizza and I don't like ice cream very much, which seems to like, my wife is Italian, so not liking gelato, not liking pizza is just, I don't know how we're still together. But no, I've got a sweet tooth, but it's for like cakes and like proper pastries and sweets. But I can only have those on the weekend, because otherwise I would be 4 times my current size.
You mentioned a very acceptable word then, the word was cake. If you're writing at the weekend and you need some cake to restore the writing for you, what cake would you be reaching for?
Oh, I love, there's a bakery not far from my house and it does a Basque cheesecake, which is the most incredible thing I've ever tasted. So again, you theoretically should only eat one small slice of that every 3 years. But it's so good. I get one every Sunday after Sunday lunch. It's ridiculous.
And what's in that? What is it?
In the Basque cheesecake, I could not tell. God's tears is, I imagine, like just ground up beautiful things, unicorns and rainbows and I don't know. Whatever magic is in this world is spun into this delectable, delectable cake. It's ridiculous.
We're all off to get the book and to investigate Basque cheesecakes. They sound delicious. And the book is wonderful. Stuart Turton, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Coming up, two more book reviews.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Now, can we get stuck straight in to Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner? It's been sitting on my bookshelves for many a year. It's a shorter book. How many pages are we looking at? 180. I loved this book so much. Why have I not read it before? I'm sure I've seen the film a while ago, and I wouldn't mind seeing the film again now I've read the book. Let me tell you a little bit about it. Into the rarefied atmosphere of the Hotel du Lac timidly walks Edith Hope, romantic novelist and holder of modest dreams. Edith has been exiled from home after embarrassing herself and her friends. She has refused to sacrifice her ideals and remains stubbornly single. But among the pampered women and minor nobility, Edith finds Mr. Neville, and her chance to escape from a life of humiliating loneliness is renewed. Let me do the first sentence for you. From the window, all that could be seen was a receding area of grey. As I say, I love this book so much. The characters, just the moment where you're just like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. It's not a book that's got the pace and the thrills and the spills. It's quite a contained book, and yet it is glorious. It needs to be made again as another film, I think. There are elements of White Lotus. You do know if you've watched that series on TV. I don't know, just felt a bit like that at times. I just thought the writing was exquisite. Bravo, bravo, Hotel du Lac, Anita Bruckner. And that was written, crikey, when was this book written? Some time ago. First published 1984. There you go. For those of us that like library books as well and might have a book on a bookshelf that you haven't read before, this could be the one that crops up. Yeah, very good. And then the final book is An Eye for an Eye by MJ Arledge. I listened to this as an audio book. Let me tell you a bit about it. They are among only 9 criminals in the UK who have been granted lifelong anonymity for their own safety because of their terrible crimes. But what if someone exposed their true identities to the families of their victims who are desperate for revenge? Probation officer Olivia Campbell is caught in the crossfire of this crisis. And as the search for the mole behind it all intensifies, so too does the hunt for the vigilante killers let loose by the leaks. Now, let me read you the first sentence. Day 1, chapter 1. He sensed them before he saw them. Short sentence. I thought it was really interesting. It made me... I learnt a lot about just what people go to escape their identities and the sacrifices they have to make as part of that. And just by posing the question then that if those secrets were not secret, but everyone could see them, how would that change? What would the victims and the victims' families think? What would the general public think? What about the criminals themselves and their families? I thought it was very interesting. And yeah, I enjoyed listening to it as an audiobook. I thought it was, yeah, good. There we are. A good book. Nothing wrong with that at all. What books have we covered today? We have covered The Last Murder at the End of the World by Stuart Turton, Hotel Dulac by Anita Bruckner, and Eye for an Eye by MJ Arledge. Those are your books. I'm sending you on your way. I haven't coughed, which is a miracle, but I definitely need to have a chocolate biscuit now. And I'm interested in this cheesecake that Stuart mentioned. I'm going to have to look that one up because I've never heard of that one. Anyway, that's it for me. I'll be back again next week. So just look after yourselves and I'll talk to you very soon. Take care now. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the QuickBook Reviews podcast. That's enough books, said no one, ever. See you again soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.